If we were to ask why the people in this room became interested in the issues that brought them to this meeting, I'll wager that a large percentage of them would give the same answer that I did. Many years ago, I got a phone call from Peter Beckman. Or, I saw the light coming out of Boulder, Colorado, in a little publication called Access to Energy that comes every month and is never on the stack of unread mail because we always read it immediately. Dr. Beckman, a native of Prague, Czechoslovakia, has written too many books to name: The Health Hazards of Not Going Nuclear, A History of Pi, and Einstein Plus Two, to name just a few. Dr. Peter Beckman.
Okay. I was saying I hope I won't disappoint you, especially as you have to listen to this on a half-empty stomach. I understand I was called in early so that we could prepare more dinners because they hadn't expected so many of you. In any case, my subject is the importance of separation of church and state, and I will begin with a joke that I'm sure most of you are familiar with, but I think it bears repeating. Gorbachev was driving in a limousine through the countryside and saw a Russian plowman, you know, not an American plowman on a combine or something, on a horse-drawn plow where he walks behind it. So he asked his driver to stop and goes to the plowman and says, "Comrade, tell me, is Marxism, Leninism a science or is it an ideology?" So this peasant scratches his head and then his chin and then his head again and meditates and thinks, and then he says, "Your Excellency, it's an ideology." So Gorbachev says, "Right, and how did you reach this conclusion?" He says, "Well, Excellency, I figured if it was a science, they would have tried it on the dogs first." Well, now, we all know the difference between science and religion. Science is based on reproducible observations or reproducible events or reproducible facts. Religion is based on faith. I cannot go to a rabbi and tell him, "Listen, what Moses saw with the burning bush that burned without consuming himself contradicts the law of conservation of energy." I cannot go to a priest and say Jesus couldn't have walked on water because it contradicts Archimedes' law, because both of them would rightly throw me out and say, "Look, this was a miracle that happened only once. It is not a reproducible event that science studies, and therefore natural laws do not apply to it." Well, the old type of religion, the old type of faith, I think in the last 100 years has declined. You know, not as many people go to church or synagogue or whatever, and science may have played its part in it, that where people saw a deity in thunder and lightning, science substituted acoustics and electricity, which reminds me of another story. Where the family sits at dinner and the head of the family asks, well, Joey, what did you learn in school today? And Joey says, well, we learned about how Moses led his people out of Egypt into the promised land, and he came to the Red Sea and he couldn't cross it. So he called in the Jewish army engineers and he ordered them to build a pontoon bridge and to tie the rafts together with bow knots. And just as all of the Jewish people were on the other side, they pulled the strings and the rafts went apart and the whole Egyptian army drowned. And the father said, is that what your teacher said? And he says, well, Daddy, not exactly. But if I told you what he did say, you'd never believe it. Well, anyway, the decline of religion left a certain void, and the human mind, or the human psyche, or whatever you want to call it, abhors a vacuum. It needs an ideology, call it religion or call it what you like. It needs a set of ground rules by which to make decisions in ethics, in morality, and in individual actions. Without this, people are at sea and they do need this. And among the many who tried to fill this void, there were successively three fake religions that filled this void: the brown, the red, and the green. What is a fake religion? A fake religion, like a genuine religion, is based on faith, not on reproducible observations. But unlike a genuine religion, it pretends to be a science. For example, the brown religion, the Nazis, had a thing called Rassenkunde, which means racology, where they measured people's noses and skulls to give a foundation to their faith that the Aryan race was superior to any other race. Well, they ignored the facts, as do all fake religions. I'll just give you two examples. One example is that the SS monster Reinhard Heydrich, who was killed in 1942, I believe, after the war, was found to have a Jewish grandmother, although he was blue-eyed, fair-haired, and a typical Aryan. The other example is that no matter how much you measure noses and skulls and everything else, there's no way you can tell an Italian from a Jew. Not only, incidentally, do they look alike, but Eastern Jews and Italians have one thing in common: they can't speak without using their hands. Which reminds me of another old Jewish story where Moshe carries a big watermelon and he sees Shloime and he says, Shloime, hi Shloime, boy, have I got news for you. Hold this melon and I'll tell you all about it. The same disregard for the facts was true of the red fake religion, which claimed to have introduced scientific socialism and a scientific economic theory, which said, for example, that the value of a product depended on the number of labor hours put into it, which means that mud pies are more valuable than apple pies. Secondly, they taught that the working class, the proletariat, gets more and more impoverished, not only relatively with respect to the others, but absolutely. Well, you know that as well as I do that the American working class is so impoverished that it has one big problem, and that is parking space. Now, the main thing I want to talk about is the green fake religion, which again works on faith, which again works with coercion, which again works with threats, and totally disregards all facts. I will not bore you again with nuclear power. I've done that too often. But I will mention something that is close, and that is food irradiation. Suppose that what they say about irradiated food, what the Greens say about irradiated food, were true, which it certainly isn't, then there is still one great difference between irradiated food and nuclear power. A region either has nuclear power or it doesn't, and the majority, however misinformed, decides which of the two it shall be. But irradiated food is clearly marked as irradiated, and you don't have to buy it if you think that chemical preservatives are better, or if you like your food with maggots and other microbacteria, you are free to do so, and I want to be free to buy irradiated food. But that is not the attitude of the Greens. The attitude of the Greens is, thou shalt eat what I eat, which shows their coercion. Because if they were for freedom, they would say, okay, if they prefer irradiated food, let them eat this dreadful poison and let them pay the price for it and die of whatever diseases it brings about. But this is not what they do. If we take other general characteristics, it is the characteristic of a threat. The Nazis said that if they don't win, you will be taken over by the Yiddish Bolshevistischen Plutokraten, which means Jewish Bolshevik plutocrats. The communists said, if you don't support us, you will have to suffer the American imperialists, and you will have to suffer being taken over by the masked agents of reaction, was the official phrase. Always painting a devil on the wall. The Greens are no different. If we don't mend our sinful ways, we will disrupt the ozone layer, we will overpopulate the planet, we will cause global warming, and so forth. They're getting better and better, as you can see. They attack property rights more and more. All the communists took over was the means of production. What they are taking over is the entire biosphere. They say the ozone layer belongs to all of us, and so on. Does it correspond to the fact? Not in the least. Global warming, number one, has never been shown to exist in the last 120 years or so. The measurements are not reliable enough to indicate that there was warming. If there was warming, there's not the slightest proof that this warming is caused by human activity. They say, well, okay, we're not sure, but let's prepare for the worst. What is the worst? There is, you know, all the people who say we're going to fry and there's going to be global warming, they're on television all the time, like Stephen Schneider of NCAR, by now a professional media monkey, tells us about how this, how it's time, even if we're not sure, to stop all CO2 and so forth. One of the many people who never gets on TV is Professor Sherwood Idso of Arizona State University, also of the experimental station, I think it's called, of the Department of Agriculture. And he does not work with computers, you know, with computer models. Schneider's computer model of global warming has precipitation in Britain and Norway the same as in the Sahara. Sherwood works not with computers, but with actual experiments in the fields, in the field. And his theory says this: nature is protected against such variations. If the greenhouse effect or other effects cause significant warming, there will be more evaporation, there will be more clouds. Clouds are white and will reflect more of the incoming energy in the first place. So if we want to be sure, even if we're not sure, just to be safe, what should we do? Should we stop all CO2 because maybe Schneider is right? Or should we fire coal and fossils and everything like crazy because maybe Idso is right? We simply don't know. The ozone layer, I don't want to take up too much time. But here again, you know, the thing is presented as if the ozone layer was a steel door and the UV was a machine gun shooting outside and you open the steel door and the UV comes in. That's not how it works. Much of the UV energy that comes into the Earth's atmosphere is absorbed not just by ozone, but by creating ozone. In fact, ozone, the whole cycle starts with the diatomic molecular oxygen, O2, which needs a certain quantum for disassociation, and that is provided by UV radiation, but they never tell you that. The ozone hole, so-called hole, which in fact is a 30% decrease in the ozone concentration for 6 weeks in September and October of each year in the Antarctic, it's not a hole, has three remarkable things. Number one, I have worked with geophysicists for many years when I was still in Czechoslovakia, with German geophysicists. And they are people, genuine scientists, who are very careful, who will work for decades, and I don't hesitate to say for centuries, as one generation hands over the result to the next generation, who are very careful people before they make a judgment. In 1984, some media monkeys discovered that the so-called ozone hole. They had not the slightest idea, like to this day they have not the slightest idea, whether this hole was there 10 years ago or whether in fact it was not there in 1984 BC. They have no idea. The second thing is that they discovered chlorine molecules there, which they ascribe to CFCs or freon leaking from refrigerators and deodorant sprays and so on, which are mostly used in the northern hemisphere. And to find chlorine in the Antarctic and call this a smoking gun, which proves that it comes from the CFC, is like finding a drowned woman and concluding that she must have been driving the Senator Edward Kennedy. Number three, it has been said you can't brush a vacuum cleaner under the carpet. Well, maybe you can't brush a vacuum cleaner under the carpet, but what you can brush under the carpet is a full-blown volcano, because in the Antarctic there is a volcano, Mount Erebus, which you can look up on the map. It's at about 77 degrees latitude, and the longitude is easy to remember, it's 180 degrees, so it doesn't matter whether it's east or west. That volcano, for reasons that I don't understand, but the volcanologists tell me that unlike Mount Etna or Mount St. Helen, it does not erupt at certain periods. It is in one continuous eruption. Please don't ask me why and how, I don't know. But that's what they tell me. But more important, this volcano puts into the Antarctic atmosphere 1,000 tons of hydrochloric acid, as far as we are concerned, you know, in the stratosphere, in photochemical effects, 1,000 tons of chlorines per day. How many people here who do not read Access to Energy have heard of Mount Erebus? One, two, three, and nobody else. So well have they brushed it under the carpet, the Greens. Acid rain. NAPAP, which means National Assessment Program for Acid for Acid Precipitation, was a program started in the Reagan administration to find out how much acid rain there is and what to do about it, which studied the problem for 10 years and cost $540 million. What NAPAP concluded is that it's no big deal. It hurts the red spruce in the Adirondacks, and some bodies of water are acid, most are alkaline, and if the acidity of those lakes worries you, you can cure it with lime for a few hundred thousand dollars and not for hundreds of million dollars. In other words, the whole thing is not a big problem. And we don't hear about acid rain much more now. Except that in the Clean Air Act, William Riley smuggled it in, completely disregarding this study that had taken 10 years and cost so much money. Recycling. The faith of recycling has nothing to do with the facts. Recycled paper costs more, uses more energy, and is of lower quality than fresh paper, and does not save any trees that need to be saved. These trees were grown in order to produce paper, and the number of trees cut in America is much lower than the number of trees grown, as you would expect, because anybody but the National Forest Service, you know, Weyerhaeuser, and anybody who has the golden goose of timber will see to it that he doesn't lose it and will plant more. The actual figures are that, depending on the species, between 20% and 150% more trees are grown than are cut in America. Recycling is a faith that makes no sense whatsoever. I am now waiting for the day when they will want to save wheat by recycling bread. Now, all of these things and more, as some of you know, you can read in Access to Energy under the column of Greenwash or other titles, but I am headed elsewhere. Would the American people tolerate a rabbi in the president's cabinet? And I don't mean a rabbi who happens to be a rabbi but is Secretary of the Treasury. I mean a rabbi who sees to it that all Americans without exception eat kosher food. Would Americans tolerate that? Would they tolerate a cardinal in the president's cabinet, not a secretary of HEW, but as one who makes sure that all of the American people use only natural contraception? Of course they wouldn't. So why do they tolerate William Riley in the president's cabinet? A green priest who has put, as I said, acid rain in the Clean Air Act, who has introduced the wetlands rules, which fortunately have been thrown out by a court recently, but anything where water stood for more than 6 days was wetlands. Even if it was a parking lot or your backyards, anything like that was wetlands. Not directly, because another agency was involved, introduced the fraud of the northern spotted owl. Let me tell you that the spotted owl from the Canadian Rockies all the way down into Texas is one of the most plentiful species. The so-called species that is endangered is the northern spotted owl, which no biologist, no taxonomist will recognize as a subspecies, but which does the political job and which led to the trouble in Oregon. It's not a biological species. Anything that the EPA and other agencies define as a subspecies whether it makes biological sense or not, is a subspecies and therefore endangered. What can we do about this? We can show people the facts and show that the Greens are a fake religion and not scientists. And when people understand that, it is my belief that they will throw out the fakers of First Amendment rights who fight for the right to urinate on the American flag, and instead will see to it that the First Amendment is really followed, for the first thing that the First Amendment says is that Congress shall make no laws respecting an established religion. Thank you very much. This is not true, as far as I know. The process of food irradiation does not, of course, make the food radioactive, but it does introduce a small amount of new substances called radiolites. These radiolites are present in lots of other foods that have not been irradiated, but that it would destroy vitamins, I have for one thing never heard before, and I wouldn't believe it, because the vitamins chemical formula, and the irradiation in general does not break up chemicals. What it does is kill microorganisms and bacteria such as Salmonella, which is widespread in the United States. Most poultry have it in the raw state. And if you don't cook it well, it leads to very nasty diseases which can be fatal. In spite of this, you know, the corporate wimps such as Kraft, some of the poultry wholesalers, General Foods, Campbell Soups, which I will remind you had botulism in their soup some years ago, and several others of these wimps have signed declarations that their food will never be irradiated, so that you can be sure that you will always get it with some bacteria and possibly with disease-causing bacteria. Yes?
Yes.
That is the kind of superstition they work with. One of the, it's not a superstition, it's the truth. One of the things that they say is that the 100,000 rads that are given to food are lethal, which is perfectly true. But when you bread is baked, you try and lie along with the bread in the oven and see what happens to you. Thank you.